So the topic this afternoon, which will conclude this Yarchi Kala, is the topic of Mesorah. So we're going to oscillate between the board I have behind me and the source packets that you have in front of you. We'll translate everything, so don't get scared off. We live, like every generation, in a complex generation of Jewish history. So we all know, we all understand that the Torah, in its eternal state, always applies in every generation, and that it applies differently in different generations. And certain halachas, certain practices, certain observations manifest themselves differently in different generations. So one of the questions that we face on an ongoing basis is, well, if we're in this generation, if we're living in the year 2015, what does that mean for everything that came before us? What is the significance of Mesorah, of tradition? What is the import of tradition? What are the contours? What does it mean for us as we make decisions individually, but specifically on a communal level? What does it mean when you think about Mesorah? How does Mesorah play into our consciousness as Torah observant Jews? I'll give you a couple of examples for us to think about, and we'll come back to them at the end. So here's one simple example that many of us have thought about. You're getting ready. It's a spring afternoon. The night before, you were up till 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. And it's Pesach. And you ever ask yourself, like, wait a second, I just did this last night, and yet we have to do it all again. This is the principle that we call Yom Tov Sheni Shel Golios, 2 days in exile. And many of us wonder sometimes when we're getting everything ready again. And some of us have been to Israel and we've seen Siddur with it, right? One and done. One and done, must speak. But we go for another round. Then the question is why? I don't understand. It's all, we'll see a little bit later. The Gemara says it has to do with the calendar. They haven't changed the calendar in like 1700 years. Now you can get it on your phone. So why are you doing Yom Tov Sheni twice? Let's say, imagine somebody, they come to shul, and they know that there, it says in the Siddur, at this point in the Shemona Esrei you bow, at this point in the Shemona Esrei you bow, there are certain places in the end of Brach of Avos and the Brach of Hodah, at the beginning of Shemona Esrei, toward the end of Shemona Esrei. Let's say somebody is really excited, they feel like, you know what, they're going to bow at every Bracha, at the end of every Bracha on Shemona Esrei. They are so psyched. And the question is, so, you know, what do you think about that? It's different than the Yom Tov Sheni question, but it's still in the same orbit. And then here's another scenario to think about, similar but also in the same orbit. Comes Friday afternoon, many in this room have the practice of lighting Shabbos candles in their home. So there is a special thing that goes on over there. For some people it looks like this, for some people it looks like this, for this, there's a whole thing going on. So what happens, you know, you're covering the candles, you're covering the eyes. Let's say you wake up one day, you're like, you know what, I'm having guests come over. It's ridiculous. It looks weird enough that I'm lighting candles on a Friday afternoon at like 6 o'clock when it's sunny outside. I feel like this whole, like, the hands thing is just too weird. I don't really understand the whole point of it anyway. You know, why am I doing that? And what about if we just say, you know what, the hands thing, I'm not a hands person. Anyway, it doesn't resonate with me. Like, how do we view these different practices? They're all different. They are different and they have different angles, but they fit into the same rubric of Mesorah. You won't find anywhere in the Chumash, you can open up a Chumash from the beginning until the end, it will not say anything about how you should hold your hands when you light Friday night candles. Nothing. And I was surprised to learn growing up when I opened the Chumash and I found it said there were only 7 days of Pesach. I always thought there were 8. Unbelievable. And then you think about all the practices that we have during davening, well, you won't find them in the Chumash. So how do we understand these things? So to do that, we need to step all the way back, and we're going to begin at the beginning, at Matan Torah. So this is a very important passage in the Torah's Kohanim, in the Medrash, which appears on Parshas Bechukosai. The Pasuk says, Eila hachukim v'hamishpatim v'hatoros, v'hatoros, multiple Torahs, melamed sheshtei toros nitnu, Lahem LeYisrael. We were given 2 Torahs at Sinai. Echad Bechtav, Ve'echad Balpeh. One of those is a written Torah, and one of those is the oral Torah. This is a core distinction, 2 things that we received at Sinai. This sometimes the Gemara refers to as Yesh Eim LeMikra, V'Yesh Eim LeMasoris. Eim like your mother, is a transmission. There is a tradition of transmission of the Mikra, of what it says, Torah Shebichtav, and Yesh Eim L'Masoris, to the tradition. So sometimes you look in, you open up a Sefer Torah, there were no vowels. So how do you know how to pronounce the word? So there's a Mikra, what does it say, the letters, and then there's a Masoris, the tradition, the oral tradition, how it's supposed to be read. Now this oral tradition is very significant. If you look on the first page of your packets, you'll find the Gemara in Maseches Gittin, where the Gemara teaches us, Am Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan taught, Lo koras HaKadosh Baruch Hu bris im Yisrael, Elo b'shvil dvarim shebal peh. Hashem created a covenant with us, not on the tablets, not on the Torah scroll. He created a covenant, a binding covenant for generations, is based on Torah shebal peh, the oral tradition. Shenemar, as it says in the pasuk, ki al pi hadvarim ha'ele, through the mouth, the verbal transmission of these words, karati itcha bris v'es Yisrael, I have cut a covenant with you. The oral Torah is perhaps the more significant of the two, and the truth is, it's easy to understand why that is. Because you open up a chumash, it's not so difficult to observe what it says in the chumash. The oral tradition is much more complex. It's much more, I would say, vast in its scope. It regulates every detail of your life. You open up the Chumash, it tells you almost nothing about how to lead a daily life. Even the interactions, let's say the monetary, the civic responsibilities, they're very sketchy. It doesn't tell you details. Torah Shebaal Peh tells you details. And that's why some are familiar in this room that there is an ongoing tension, right? On the one hand, we said Nasa V'Nishma. On the other hand, the Gemara says, what did God do? He put a barrel over our heads. It was called Har Sinai. Kaf Aleim Har Kigigis. So which one was it? Did we want it or did we not? So the Medrash Tanchuma says, I'll tell you. When he came to us with the Torah Shebichsav, we flipped through it. We're like, all right, half of the thing is stories. Excuse me, language. Half of it is stories. A couple of laws. Many of them are Kavanos. The Kohan will do all of that. No problem. We'll take it. Then the Rosh Hashanah said, well, there's something else. There's a whole tradition that's going to be passed on orally. And then we said, no, not so fast. So the Baal Shem say, okay, look, I'm going to put the barrel over your head because you can't have one without the other. These are two Torahs, and they go together. But it's not just that they are necessary. In a certain sense, there's something beautiful about the Torah Shebaal Peh. If you look on the next page, there is a comment of the Tur, Rav Yaakov ben Asher. So he's living in the 14th century. And this is the first four-section breakdown of the Code of Jewish Law. So this is in Hilchos Kriyas Sefer Torah, and he tells us the Nusach, this is on page 2, the Nusach, the Matbeya Shel Bracha Achrona. What is the structure of the blessing on the study of Torah? He says, Asher Nosan Lonu Toras Emes, V'chaye Olam Nata B'Sochenu. Many of us are familiar with this Bracha. So he focuses beautifully on the syntax here, and then on the language. The syntax is that there are two descriptions. There's Nosan Lonu Toras Emes, A, and then there is V'chaye Olam Nata B'Sochenu. The first one is he gave us a Torah of truth, and then a living, an eternal life. He was Nata B'Sochenu. What does the word Nata mean? He planted in us. It's organic. It's growth oriented. He says Pirush Torahs Emes. He Torah Shebichsav. V'chaye Olam Nata B'Sochenu. He Torah Shebaal Peh. The truth, the hard truth, that's the written tradition. But the oral tradition, that is the Chaye Olam. That's the life of Torah. That's the second part of the bracha. Whenever we say Birchas HaTorah, we're saying a bracha on two things. On both Torahs. On the Torah Shebichsav and on the Torah Shebaal Peh. And the Torah Shebaal Peh includes many things. Well, how did it move along? So the Rambam tells us his introduction to his amazing work. Thank you so much. I have to drink somewhere that I started before. Oh, that's where it is. Thank you. So the Rambam tells us, this is actually a 1520s copy from the JTS library of a depiction of the beginning of Perkei Avos. Moshe Kibol Torah Misinai. Moshe received the Torah at Sinai, and he gave it to Yehoshua. I'm sorry if I'm blocking if you can't see. So Moshe Rabbeinu got the Torah. He didn't just get the written Torah. He got all of these components, various components of the oral Torah. And the Rambam says, we know exactly how it was passed down. Moshe Rabbeinu, he received the Torah and he passed it to his student Yehoshua. who then subsequently gave it to the Kohen who was Pinchas, who afterwards gave it to the famous Kohen who was late, Eli, who gave it to the prophet Shmuel, who gave it to Dovid HaMelech, and each of these is, according to the Rambam, the Baalei HaMasorah. They are the arbiters and the stewards of the tradition. From Dovid HaMelech to the prophet Achiah HaShiloni, who gave it to his student Eliyahu, to Elisha, to Yehoyada HaKohen, then to the series of prophets, Zechariah, Hosea, Amos, Yeshaya, Micha, Yoel, Nachum. These are the 12, they're not minor prophets. They're called the minor prophets. They were major prophets. Habakkuk, Tzfanya, Yirmiyah. Yirmiyahu comes later. Baruch was Yirmiyahu's scribe, and then he hands it to Ezra. Ezra, so far, is now going to transition it to the Anshe Knesset HaGedola. Shimon HaTzadik is from the end of the Anshe Knesset HaGedola, and then he sends it to the pairs. This is familiar from us from the beginning of Pirkei Avos. Pairs, Zugos, all the way after Shema and Naphtali to the famous Hillel and Shammai, and then to the tradition of the teachers of Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi at the conclusion of the Mishnah 35, and then you have the Talmud 36 through 40. So it's tradition that is unbroken from teacher to student, number one Moshe Rabbeinu to number 40. That is the closing rabbinic authority, Rav Ashi. So says the Rambam, this is Ravina Rav Ashi Sof Horah. This is the end of authoritative rule. Anything that appears in the Talmud as a ruling is universally binding on all of Klal Yisrael. Why is that? Because that was, the Rambam says, the last great assembly of the Jewish Chachamim, the Jewish sages, who could decide on various matters of Jewish law, specifically in Torah Shebaal Peh, in understanding and applying the tradition. So here we go. We've got now the people, the individuals who gave us the Masorah, and what did they give us? They gave us a corpus of law that was passed down to the Savoraim, who are not so well known. That's the period before the Gaonim, Rishonim, Achronim, and Poskim. They gave us the oral tradition that's going to continue to be applied through the generations. But the oral tradition has multiple components. We could call them the learning tradition and the living tradition. And this is introduced to us by a figure who we're going to talk about and is the basis of much of what we're sharing today. And his name is Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. He was born in Pruzhen, I think it was 1903. He died in 1993. He was one of the great rabbinic luminaries of the 20th century. So on Gimel Shvat, after his father, Rav Moshe Halevi Soloveitchik, passed away in 1941, he used to deliver a yahrzeit shiur. Hundreds of people would come to Rav Soloveitchik's yahrzeit shiur. It would last for 4 hours, and people would not move. It was 2 hours of halacha, 2 hours of agada. It was given in the Lamport Auditorium, which is, I believe, where he's standing right here in this picture. This picture is taken from, in the 40s. And he would deliver a yahrzeit shiur on Gimel Shvat for his father. And one year, he focused on this question of Masorah, of tradition. So if you look in the next pages of your packet, you will find three Rambams. Now the problem is that when I Xerox the packets, the Rambams are in reverse order. You need to start with page 5, move back to page 4, and then to page 3. Just keeps you on your toes. And it's added fun because it's dark. So you have to really look carefully. So the Rambam says, Rav Soloveitchik, let's look at it carefully. Now, he spoke for 4 hours. We're going to take 2 minutes of his understanding. The Rambam says in the second parak of Hilchos Mamrim, and where this is where he discusses, I'm on page 5 now, where he talks about Perak Sheni, the contours of Torah Shebaal Peh. He says, Beis Din HaGadol, the great rabbinic court, the, where they were headquartered in Yerushalayim, in the Beis HaMikdash, and it was called the Lishka Sagazis, in their office, Shedarshu Ba'achas Min Amidos Kefima Shenira Be'eneim. They had rabbinic tools. I'll give you an example. One is called a Gzeira Shava, where you compare two different words. This is a group of rabbinic tools that the rabbis used to read between the lines. They had a piece of text. It was called the Torah Shebichsav, and they read in between the lines, they compared. So they had rabbinic tools. In every generation, we don't do this today, but in the old days, the rabbis would look at the Torah Shebichsav, and they would take the rabbinic tools that they had, and they would use those tools to analyze the Chumash, and to glean from there various applications to our lives. And that could change from generation to generation, depending on how they applied the methodology of studying the Chumash. So let's say in one generation, They followed, they ruled kefima shenira be'eneim shadin kach, whatever they thought was the correct rule, v'dono din, and they established the rule. V'amar acharim bezdin acher, and another rabbinic court came along. V'nira lo tam acher, they wanted to do it differently. So, no problem. Hariz esosir v'don kefima shenira be'eneim. Imagine, we could have one rabbinic court in one generation, they could rule that it's prohibited to do a certain practice. And then the next generation, they could say it's permitted. Maybe you could think about the story of Rus. What may be the tension, says the Beis Halevi, going on in the story of Rus? Why didn't the other relative want to marry Rus? Maybe he wasn't so convinced that the rabbinic rule of Amoni velo Amonis, only men and not women, maybe that's not so, as it's in Yiddish, not so oisgehalten. Maybe I'm pen ashkisas nachalasi. Maybe today the rabbis will say that we're married, but maybe in another generation they'll change it. So the Gemara says that's why Boaz had to bang on the table. He says, no, it's a tradition. It cannot be changed. It's a tradition all the way back from Moshe Rabbeinu. But according to the Rambam, there's one aspect of Torah Shebichsav, and that is that in the old days, the days of the Talmud, the rabbis would use their rabbinic tools of learning and assess what are the halachos in the Torah. And that, says the Rambam, could change from generation to generation. But then, in the next halacha, where I put the little number 2, the Rambam says, well, something else. Bezdin shegazru gzeira, a rabbinic court, the great sages of the generation, who enacted a decree. They're not saying this is what the Chumash means. They're saying, we want to establish something for the contours of our community. Oh, hiskinu takana, they established a takana, v'enhigu minug, and they established a practice. Upashat b'chol, kol hadavar b'chol Yisrael. Everybody accepted this practice. It's a practice. It's not in the Chumash. It's not even derived from the Chumash. It's a practice that the rabbis established for us. And then, somebody wants to come, excuse me one second, and change their mind? The Rambam says, there's only one way to do that. The later rabbinic court must be greater in number and in wisdom. They don't have the authority to change the precedent that was set by the earlier generations. And the Rambam, go back to page 4, the Rambam says, the previous page where I put the little 3, the Rambam says even further, Bamed dvarim amurim, when am I talking about? B'dvarim shelo osru oson kedei lasos siyag ela b'shar dinei haTorah. That's when it comes to things that were not to protect, a protective fence around the Torah. Aval dvarim shero bezdin ligzor oles or oson lasos siyag in pashat isurun b'chol Yisrael ein bezdin hagadol acher yachol la'akron u'lahatiron afilo hayagadol min harishonim. You could have the greatest best in the world, but the laws of Muktza, for example, you won't find the laws of Muktza anywhere in the Chumash. They are a rabbinic decree. But they are a rabbinic decree. Now, there are many discussions as to why. One reason is that you shouldn't carry outside into the public square and to create a fence around other things. The Rambam says, no later rabbis have the authority to undo that decree. And Rav Soloveitchik develops a whole tapestry of a shir trying to understand, well, wait a second, why is it that in the first category, the later rabbis have the authority to re-understand, to analyze the text and come up with a different conclusion? Whereas in the second category, where it comes to gzeros, either they have to be greater or they don't have any authority. And Rav Soloveitchik explains, he says, I'll tell you why. He says, because Torah Shebal Peh, the oral tradition, has two tracks. Shtei Masoros Yeshnan. There are two mesoros. One is mesoros achas hamisyacheses kula lemesoros shel limud. One mesora is the tradition of learning. And then there's a totally separate and distinct mesora. That's what we could call the mesora of living. The second was mesora ma'asit shel hanhagas klal Yisrael. And what is that predicated on? The practical? Sha'al avicha v'yagedcha. Ask your father the way they did it before. It's not based on the learning. It's based on what Rav Schwartz Shlita has told me many times, the halachic profile of a community. And this has great significance. If you look on the next page of your source sheet, you'll find the Gemara in Maseches Yevamos, page 6. The Gemara in Yevamos is discussing how to do chalitza. Chalitza is a procedure if, unfortunately, a man dies, his wife doesn't have any children, and there is a brother, so the wife has to either marry the brother, the Levirate marriage, or perform this procedure called chalitza. And the Gemara has a discussion. There are two options how to do chalitza. One is with a shoe, a minol, and the other one is with a sandal, with a sandal. And already in the times of the Talmud, and by the way, you can go today to the CRC in the office there, they have a, they call it a chalitza shoe, but it's not really a shoe. It has straps. It's a sandal. So already, you could do both. Either one is good. But already in the times of the Talmud, they used to use a sandal, one with straps. So the Gemara has an amazing, amazing statement. Amar Rav Kahana, Amar Rav, in the underline. Im yavo Eliyo v'yomar. If Eliyo showed up at our doorstep today and said, Choltzin b'minol, you do chalitza with a shoe? Shomen lo. No problem. We agree you could do chalitza with a shoe. Ein choltzin b'sandol. Let's say Eliyo HaNavi came, knocked on the door and said, your practice is incorrect. You may not do chalitza with a sandal. You should do it, not that you may not, you should not. You should do it with a shoe rather than with a sandal. Says the Gemara, Ein shomen lo. Don't listen to him. Why not? Shekvar noagu ha'am b'sandal. The practice has been that we use a sandal, and that's what we use. You're right. From a legal, technical learning standpoint, you could have used either one. And Eliyahu HaNavi is telling you use one. But from a Jewish living standpoint, from the profile of our halachic community, Eliyahu can't change the profile of our community. That's the way that it's always been. And this has two incredible milas, two incredible gifts. And I turn your attention to a beautiful article. I'm giving you just one slice of it that appeared 5 years ago in a Jewish Action by Rabbi Dr. Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb. Rabbi Weinreb points out that there are two very significant aspects and contributions of the fact that we have this halachic profile, the Mesorah of Jewish living. Somebody want to read where I put the little A, that paragraph? Vakasha, go ahead. Yeah, secondly, we're going to start with secondly. Go ahead.
I see the...
Go ahead.
Secondly, Mesorah is not a cultural hodgepodge of practices accumulated over the ages in a variety of diaspora settings. Rather, every important component of Mesorah reflects some basic Jewish value. There are overarching concepts in our religion under which specific halachos and minhagim are subsumed. The custom of keeping Yom Tov Shein, for example, in spite of our contemporary certainty regarding the accuracy of our calendar, underscores the fundamental distinction between the Holy Land and the lands of the diaspora upon which our religion insists.
Perfect, thank you. So the first aspect that Rabbi Weinreb points out is that there are many Torah values that are communicated in these practices. And they may not be known to us, or they may not even be the primary motivation for why this practice was established. But through the halachic profile, these values, sometimes meta-halachic values, are transmitted. That's one. But then there is the second. Anybody want to read B? Some other volunteer. Bakasha. Thank you.
Firstly, there is intrinsic value to continuity and to tradition. The traditions of our ancestors helped guarantee that they would survive the vicissitudes of Jewish history. The complex combination of adhering to practical habits, maintaining attitudes of hope, clinging to a community, gaining inspiration from worship, and finding meaning in a consistent daily regimen is known as Mesorah. And it is precisely those elements of Jewish life that have resulted in each and every one of us being here today. Mesorah, whatever else it may be, has proven to be of immense practical value to Jewish people. It should not be frivolously rejected. The fashions and fancies passing moment partly possess the promise of ensuring a Jewish future for posterity.
Beautiful. So what does Mesorah accomplish? It gives us that connection, that concept of Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, that transcends time. And I think there are two dimensions of this observation. That picture, by the way, was of the great synagogue in Florence, which is a symbol of Mesorah. It's very old. This concept of Mesorah exists in two different directions. In a certain sense, it is our connection to the people who came before us. When we practice something that has been practiced for many, many generations, we are hearkening back to those incredible individuals, many of them who performed these same practices under the most incredible circumstances. I'm sharing with you on the next two pages, on pages 8 and 9, a piece from a translated piece of work. This volume is called Kiddush Hashem, Jewish Religious and Cultural Life in Poland During the Holocaust, by Shimon Huberband. Shimon Huberband At the beginning of the war, his wife and the rest of his family was murdered, but he spent at least a year and a half, I believe, maybe a little longer, in the Warsaw Ghetto. He was an observant Jew who participated in the Oneg Shabbos archives, and he documented things that went on, Jewish life that was going on in the ghetto. And I'm sharing with you a piece from chapter 16, which he describes the women's use of mikvos during the time of the Warsaw Ghetto. And to think about that, when women have the opportunity to use the mikveh today, they are connecting with the heroes. Who? What's described here, it's the mamish superhuman. He describes how at a certain point all the mikvos in Warsaw were closed. So what happened? So some women began to travel who had the ability to travel. They had the means. They traveled to nearby communities. What about women who didn't have that ability? So they began raising funds. The second paragraph. In the beginning of the winter of 1940, a law was issued forbidding Jews to travel by train without special lice passes. Soon afterwards, Jews were forbidden to travel by train altogether, even with such passes. Following the pronouncement of the travel ban, a whole series of cities could no longer be reached by Jewish women. The latter began to concentrate their journeys on three cities, Rembertov, Pruzhkov, and Piasetsno. Primarily, four women traveled to Rembertov. A group of women would get together, hire a coachman, and travel there by wagon. They would leave Warsaw in the middle of the day in order to return before the nighttime curfew. The cost of such a group excursion was relatively low. The greatest number of women traveled to Pruzhkov, which was the most convenient town for women to reach. The trolley ran regularly to Pruzhkov, and one did not need to present lice passes to travel by trolley. Each and every day one could witness the identical scene, Jewish women filling the trolleys to Pruzhkov in the afternoon hours. The scene attracted particular attention because each woman carried a little bag underneath her arm. When the trolley reached Pruzhkov, a great panic would erupt among the women. Each one sought to leave the trolley first so as to reach the mikveh earlier, catch a spot online, complete the ritual procedure, and return to Warsaw before the curfew. When the afternoon trolley arrived in Pruzhkov, the town was thrown into a tumult by the hundreds of Jewish women running in the direction of the local mikveh. And he describes further and further the unbelievable Mesiras Nefesh of these women to observe the mitzvah of Taharas HaMishpacha under the most adverse conditions. It's incredible. It's mamash incredible. So when we observe the same practices, when we go through the same practices in our own lives, whether it's in this area of halacha or any area of halacha, we are connecting, we are going back in time to connect with those who came before us for hundreds and thousands of years, even some of the most heroic figures. All of a sudden that's brought into our lives. That's one aspect of it. And then there's the other aspect, which is that it's the other direction. In a certain sense, when we study Torah and when we observe the same practices, we're bringing them into our lives. We're making them, in a certain sense, alive. When we sit at the Seder table and we tell the teachings of Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah, all of a sudden, in a certain sense, Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah is part of our Seder table. When we go through these practices and all of our aspects of Jewish lives, the many rabbinic figures, and that's one of the great opportunities that we have in life, is to study and learn all of these sources and the origins of these practices, many of which you will never find in the Chumash. Some of them you won't even find in the Talmud. But the great sages who created, who initiated, who structured this communal profile, they become part of our lives. In 1974, Rav Soloveitchik was invited to a Pidyon HaBen. The family name is Karasik. And somebody there had the wisdom, maybe the audacity, to bring a tape recorder. And he captured on tape Rav Soloveitchik describing what it's like in his shiur. And he describes how he comes into the shiur room and he sits down and he's an old man. And he looks across and he sees these boys. He says they're young enough to be his grandchildren. And he thinks, what connection do they have to each other? How can they find even a common language? He is, and as he describes, the autumn of his life, with the melancholy of old age, he says, as only an old person can understand. And these boys are in the spring of their life. And he says, I sit down to give the shiur, I'm an old man, and they're young boys. And then, all of a sudden, the door opens, and someone walks in the door. It's a man, says Rav Soloveitchik, who's even older than I am. It's my grandfather, Rav Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, the man who revolutionized Torah study, the study of Talmud. And then he describes even further. And I thank all of the various Google images that I ripped off for this piece. Listen carefully.
Some of the visitors lived in the 11th century, some in the 12th century, some in the 13th century, some lived in antiquity. Rabbi Akiva, Rashi, Rabbi Nathan, the Hayat, the Rashba. More and more tapis coming. Of course, what do I do? I introduce them to my pupils and the dialogue commences. The Rambam says something, the Rambam disagrees. But sometimes it's very nasty. Very sharp. How strong is Jesus at the time? A boy jumps up to defend the Rambam at the time. And the boy is fresh, you know, he's a boy, so young boys are fresh. So he wanted to use his improper, he uses improper language, so I correct you. And another boy jumps up with a new idea. The Rashba smiles gently. I try to analyze what the old boy meant. Another boy intervenes. We call upon the Rabbi Nathan to express his opinion, and suddenly a symposium of generations comes into existence. Generations, young boys, and
this is what Rav Soloveitchik refers to as Mispar Hadoros Lefonov, the connection between generations. On one level, we are reaching back to them, but on another level, they are reaching down to us. When we study in this room, when we learn Torah, when we connect to the Dvar Hashem, and specifically to the Mishsorah of Torah Shebaal Peh, we bring into our lives all of these great figures. So now we can reflect back on the significance, the great significance of Mesorah. So you could look at page 10, and we'll look at each one of these three examples. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Beitza on Daf Dalet Amud Beis, "Mistaber de'idna yadina bekfiya diyarcha v'koavdinon treyomi." We know already in the time of Ravina and Ravashi, the close of the Talmud, we already know the fixed calendar. So why bother to observe two holidays, 2 days of Yom Tov and Chutz Laretz? Says the Gemara, even though we know it, my time, the second underline, my time, Avdinan Treyome, why do we observe 2 days of Yom Tov? Mishum Deshalchum Itam, because they sent a message from there, and I would say homiletically, they sent a message all the way back from Moshe Rabbeinu to Yehoshua, to Pinchas, to Eli, they sent us a message. Hizaru b'minag avaseichem b'yadeichem. Be careful. Be sensitive to the practices, the minhagim of your parents. You never know what's going to come along. Zimnin degazru malchus k'zeira va'asi l'kal kule. Maybe the circumstances will change and you will have lost your connection to tradition. Of course, we know when the calendar is today. But we observe Yom Tov Sheni because that's our minug. That's the halachic profile of a chutz la'aretz, of a diaspora community. And on that, we recite a bracha. Tosfos on the next page, on page 11. So Tosfos is living now in the 12th century, the 13th century. Tosfos describes something. He says he finds something very troubling. Because the Gemara in the bracket here on the page says, Om Rabbi Yehuda, kach hayu minhago shel Rabbi Akiva. When Rabbi Akiva would daven, the great sage of the Tanaim, kishahayim espalo, when he would daven im atzibur, with the community, he would daven very briefly, very succinctly, so he wouldn't burden everyone. When he would daven by himself, what would happen? He would start davening Shemoneh Esrei over here. By the time he was finished with all of his bowing and jumping, he would end up with Shemoneh Esrei on the other end of the room. He was so moved, bowing all the time. So Tosfos asks a question based on their dialectic mouth. He says, I don't understand. On the left-hand side in the underlined. We have another Gemara that says that we don't bow at the conclusion of every bracha. So how could Rabbi Akiva be jumping around? So Tosfos says, you know what, Rabbi Akiva, he was not bowing at the end of the bracha. He was bowing in the middle of the bracha. Because there's no minhag, there's no regulation about bowing in the middle of a bracha. But at the end of the bracha, he only bowed at the same places that we bow. The question is why? So Tosfos says at the end, I'll tell you why. She'ein lishchos besof brachos elahecha detikon. We don't bow at the end of a bracha except where Chazal instituted it. Why not? So if you look on the next page, on page 12, you have a tshuva from the Chavasior, Rav Yori Bach Raff, which we're not going to see the context of this tshuva, it's not for us right now. Living in Germany in the 17th century, he says, this Tosfos is teaching us an important principle. Mikol makom yesh lachush, in the underline, you should be careful. She'al yedei kach, if you start too many changes without being sensitive to the contours of the profile of the halachic community, yechal shu koach, Yachlashu koach haminog, the power of custom will become weakened. Shel b'nei Yisrael, of the Jewish people. Shegam kein Torahim, they're also Torah. V'yeh kol echad ve'echad bone b'ma le'atzmo. Everybody's going to go and build their own altar. Everybody's going to decide what they want to do and how their practice is going to look. And it's going to be all over the place. Al pis faroso, according to whatever they think. And what's going to happen? Umichsi mili derabbanan kechucha v'itulula. Rabbinic Judaism is going to look like a joke because everybody's going to decide whatever they want. V'yavol azalzel, and they're going to not adequately respect the tradition, the Torah Shebaal Peh. So we have to be very careful. He says that's what Tosfos is teaching us. Maybe there's nothing technically on the books. You can't point to a Gemara that says there's a prohibition to bow at the end of the bracha. But Tosfos says Rabbi Akiva was very sensitive to the tradition. And then 13. Rav Moshe Isserles, coming to us live from Krakow, the end of the 16th century, beginning of the 17th century, says, you know why the women put their hands over the candles? According to Aruch HaShulchan, it's over their eyes. He says, I'll tell you why. Because there's a great rabbinic debate. Maybe people don't think about it. But this debate is actually being communicated silently from mother to daughter when they teach, those who are blessed to teach how to light candles. It's being communicated without words. Because there is a great debate whether or not the bracha, the blessing on the lighting of the candles, comes before the lighting or after the lighting. And there's a debate both in Hilchos Shabbos and also in Hilchos Yontif, how that practice is supposed to go. Differences between Sfardim and Ashkenazim. So what do we do? When it comes to Shabbos, we have the practice of lighting the candles first and saying the bracha afterward. Because we're concerned that if you light the candles first, you will have accepted Shabbos. Excuse me, if you said the bracha first, you'll accept the Shabbos, and you can no longer light the candles. So we light the candles first, and then you say the bracha. Says the Ramah, but you know what? We have a sensitivity. The Ramah says in the script, "Hu kadesh yeh over la'asiyasan," we always want to recite a bracha before we perform the mitzvah, and in this case, what do? We recite it afterwards. So what do? Lo yehena mimena ad la'achar habracha. We have a practice not to benefit from the light, not to enjoy it, until after you make the bracha. Umisimin hayad lefnei haner. And therefore, we put our hands over the candles, so that, even though we lit the candles already, when we say the bracha, until we say the bracha, you haven't really enjoyed the beauty of the neiros until you take your hands away. Achar hadlacha. And therefore, what do? Umavarchin v'achar kach mesalkin hayad. We make the bracha, and then we take our hands away, and we enjoy the beauty of the Shabbos Neiros. So on the one hand, of course, every community and every era and every circumstance is unique. And we need to apply the Mesorah differently in different generations, in different contexts. But the idea of Mesorah and the idea of being rooted in this tradition is exceedingly important. And I would say, the take-home, I think, are three components. Number one is that there's no such thing as Judaism without Mesorah. Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, Torah Shebaal Peh includes many things. It includes the Mesorah of learning and the Mesorah of living. And even in the Mesorah of living, there's a hierarchy of different aspects. We saw in the beginning how the Mesorah is guided by the stewards of Torah. We call the Baalei HaMesorah, the chief purveyors of Mesorah, from Moshe Rabbeinu all the way down until our own very day, the great sages of the generations. Not everybody who's a rabbi, I'm technically a rabbi, I'm not a great sage of the generation, but I know people who are. I've seen them, I've heard them, I've learned from them. They exist in every generation, the sages of that generation. And finally, the link between the generations, the importance of that continuity is really what keeps us connected. So as a coda, I share with you at the end of your packet the transcript of that talk from Rav Soloveitchik. It's about a 9-minute clip, which is available online, so you have the whole transcript. And finally, you have one page you can take with you. This comes from a website. Now, I can't document every one of the Gaonim, because in the Meiri has a Hakdama, Rav Nachum Meiri, a Provençal great Rishon from the 14th century, 13th century. So he documents all of the generations, but he stops at his generation, and the Gaonim, he doesn't do Rebbe to Talmud. So the Gaonim here is a little bit fuzzy, but essentially, I can tell you that from myself, now I'm not from the Baalei HaMesorah, but I'm just standing here, I had the privilege, and I still have the privilege, of learning from three people, three great Torah giants. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, Rav Schwartz Shlita, Rav Shechter Shlita. These were three chief disciples of Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. And you can follow the Soloveitchik dynasty all the way back to the great Rabbanim, the great Gaonim, all the way through the centuries, all the way to Moshe Rabbeinu. So to realize that we are a part of this, we are a part of this Mesorah. The contours of a halachic community are shaped by these great individuals who come all the way from Moshe Rabbeinu down to us, I think gives us some perspective on the significance of Mesorah and how it's important to integrate it properly in a balanced way in the halachic life that we live today. I thank you all for listening and for coming. Special thank you to Yitzi Metanki and to Kayla Eisenbach for all of their technical expertise, especially in setting this up. And I wish you all a really fantastic day. Yashar Koach.